listening to a podcast from The National.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Extra Time Football Podcast. I'm your host this week, Steve Luckins, filling the considerable shoes of John Turner. I'm joined this week by our guest, sports reporter John McCauley. John, welcome to the show.
Cheers, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Good stuff. And the mighty triumphant return of sports editor Graham Cagill. Graham, how are you?
Thank you. Good to be back.
Lovely stuff. Lovely stuff. Well, plenty to cover on this week's show. We'll be talking about Manchester City's sensational win over champions Chelsea, in which Kevin De Bruyne burgeoned his growing reputation as the most important player in Guardiola's side. We'll look at Tottenham's dismantling of Huddersfield thanks to a Harry Kane masterclass. Peter Crouch showing why he's indispensable at Stoke. Arsenal building momentum. And Watford's never say die attitude. We'll also be joined on the phone by our Premier League correspondent Richard Jolly to discuss a rampant Manchester United and Ronald Koeman's predicament at Everton following yet another defeat. Right, gents, let's get straight into it. Manchester City, they faced their biggest test of the season. They passed it with flying colours against Chelsea. In fact, the 1-0 scoreline might suggest a close game, but City were in total control of that game, highlighted by a superb strike from Kevin De Bruyne. Now, we've talked about Kevin De Bruyne before. Each week he seems to get better and better, John.
Yeah, totally agree. It was strange that as soon as he exchanged the pass with Gabriel Jesus, you were thinking he's going to score this, even though it was on his so-called weaker foot and outside the box. It was just his contribution the whole way through. He wins the match, obviously, but him and Silva were fantastic the whole way through the match, and I thought De Bruyne was the standout between those two, which is saying something. And I thought City's game plan was just executed to perfection, and it was almost as if they were the home team and they thought they need to take the game to Chelsea. And you've got to remember, they're playing at the champions from last year, who've started to really click. I know that Chelsea played Atletico Madrid in the Champions League, and Conte,
he was not happy about the scheduling of this game,
no,
was he?
I don't think that really helped as well, because even before the match had started, you were thinking, I don't know if that feeds into the kind of mental side of it as well.
It's almost like he's given his players an excuse.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And that's not what you need against a Manchester City team that have been pretty rampant so far this season. I just thought they just did, I would imagine they did everything that Guardiola wanted them to, and that was very much winning the Guardiola way, the way that he would have expected from last year. And as well, that, you know, I thought it was no coincidence that he seemed pretty buoyant after the match. I know he can be quite abrasive sometimes, but it just seemed as if that was his team carrying out his game plan, and crucially for them as well, with no mistakes, which has been their Achilles heel this season.
Now, Graham, we talk about the high press and quick transition being a hallmark of Guardiola teams. And that was perfectly illustrated by the goal. City regained possession on the centre circle, and within three touches, Thibaut Courtois is picking the ball out the back of the net.
That's the thing they're so good at, is that when they obviously have a lot of the ball, but when they don't, their work rate is fantastic. They're immediately closing down and putting pressure on players. Like, there was a moment in the first half I absolutely loved when Courtois had a goal kick and passed it out to the right and got passed back to him. And it was a simple little passing around the penalty area. And for most teams, you wouldn't even bother trying to challenge it. But Sané was straight on Courtois, and we were a little bit more lucky.
Yeah, he very nearly came unstuck as well, didn't
but
he?
It was just fantastic. And it kind of just embodies what City are about, because when they don't have the ball, they're straight on you, pressuring you and hurrying. And it's not going to work every time, but if you put pressure on players, they will make bad decisions, or the pass might not go to feet. And as you said, they managed to get the ball back in the centre circle and hit them back. And it kind of just embodies everything about it. I don't know if Guardiola underestimated the Premier League, or it's taken him a little while to get there, but this does feel like a Guardiola team in the Premier League, and it's frightening.
Well, they're showing much more resolve this season as well, I think you find. But another important aspect of Saturday's win was the fullbacks. Now, we all know Chelsea's lineup; they like to make the pitch very big with their two wing backs. Guardiola totally dissected that by having his fullbacks play very narrow. Overcrowd in the midfield, where Fabregas, Kante and Bakayoko were completely overrun. Bit of a masterstroke from Pep there.
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. And I think Fabian Delph, as I've been told is how you pronounce his first name, it's not Fabian, he's come in and done really, really well on that left-hand side with Mendy being out. And that we all thought was going to be a huge loss for the remainder of the season. We still think it will be, but everyone kind of bought into it. And I think Kyle Walker ended up playing a bit more on the inside as well, alongside two centre-backs. And it just looked as if Guardiola knew exactly what he was needing to be done from that match, or what needed to be done, I should say, and that his team bought into that and carried it out, as I said, to almost to a T. But I think as well, Ederson, you know, in pre-season I thought, is this really an upgrade on Bravo? And he played very, very well in terms of sweeping up at the back, and he allows the rest of the team to push up and squeeze the play further forward. And then you've got the three guys up front with Sané and Sterling on either wing.
And against the backdrop of Sergio Aguero's injury in a car crash in Amsterdam being ruled out of the game, they didn't miss him.
No. And again, at the home of the champions, the reigning champions, it was just very, very impressive.
Well, let's move on from London to West Yorkshire, where Spurs were simply scintillating in a 4-0 win over Huddersfield Town in a scoreline that actually flattered the hosts, I think you could say. Spurs looked incredible. Every player seemed to have so much time on the ball. The wing-backs always had an ocean of green in front of them every time they were on the ball. And, of course, another two goals to cap a superb September for Harry Kane, Graham.
And I think we've been joking about this before in the office about the fact that I imagine Harry and Tottenham are probably campaigning for the Premier League to start in September because they'd be absolutely frightening with him. Like, because obviously it was a bit of a freak August that he had, and it's a weird statistic that's now just gaining more and more ground. But
a barren August, 13 goals in is it 8 club games?
Club games for club and country.
Yeah, it's almost a redundant month for him, isn't it, August?
It's a very, very odd scenario. And I think Huddersfield Town had a major reality check to life in the Premier League because they've done really well. They've started well. They've got points when they should be getting points. And going into the game, I'm sure they probably thought Tottenham as like a bonus match. Whatever if they can get anything, they're playing one of the top sides, an established side, great. And after about 20 minutes, I think it was a case of welcome to the Premier League.
Yeah, and a lot of it was their own undoing. Mm-hmm. I mean, a clearing header from Kieran Trippier, badly defended, allowing Harry Kane for the first goal. And again, for his second goal, a throw-in that seemed like it was allowed to travel the size of a Rory Delap throw before it got to Kane. And don't get me wrong, he still had plenty to do with the finish. But do you think the bubbles burst on Huddersfield after their fantastic start to the season?
I don't know if it's burst. I think, as Graham said, it's a reality check. It's a bit of an eye-opener. I think that the way they play and they try and impose themselves on, which is very, very commendable, on opposition teams, despite the fact that they've taken the big step up this year, I think that was shown that's not the way that they should approach matches against the really elite teams in the league, the top sixes, as it's basically turning out to be at the moment. I don't think the bubble's burst. I just think that they would need to rein it in a little and maybe be a bit more kind of streetwise whenever they're playing against the big teams. And I know that's difficult because they don't really have that experience, but they'll gain a lot of experience from the match on Saturday.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, as you touched on, Gray, they did well against the teams that, when they're ticking off on the calendar where they can get points, and they did, and they probably would have expected to suffer a defeat to a team like Tottenham. And in fairness, I think Tottenham would have put 4 goals past a lot of teams based on that performance.
I think as well, sorry Graham, I think coming into the match, where Huddersfield, did they have the second best defensive record in the league?
3 goals conceded, and then in their previous 6 games, and then 3 on that day. So after 90 minutes, they doubled the amount of goals they conceded.
Well, playing
against Harry. I'm terrible at maths, haven't I? Seven goals.
I didn't even pick you up on
that. I'll stick with words.
I think this is just, as I said, they played against one of the really, really big teams in the league and got found out, and they'll learn from that.
Now, Graham, the focus of our podcast last week was on the league's top marksmen, Sergio Aguero, Alvaro Morata, Romelu Lukaku, and of course, Harry Kane. Now, I think there was a general consensus, wasn't there, Colts, that we would all, if we had the money, we would probably all plump for Aguero. But it's getting very hard to ignore Harry Kane as almost the complete centre forward at the moment, especially with performances like that.
No, absolutely, I'd agree with that. And considering where he's come from 3 seasons ago and how he's just, and what I love is the work rate and the fact that he continues works in his game. Obviously, it helps he's got Dele Alli and Christian Eriksen behind him, setting him up for stuff. And that's the same for any striker in respect. But I would probably be more tempted to plump for Kane because, yeah, he had a bit of a knock last season. But you kind of know with Sergio Aguero, like, obviously no one was predicting car crash this time, but you know realistically, in recent seasons, you're probably at best going to get 30, 31 games out of him in a league season. And if you're going for the title, and the way the title is looking this season, it's important for City that they've got a lot of depth so they can actually cope with this, because they might not always have had that in the past. Well, you feel, and the big thing for Tottenham as well is, like, Harry's sensational for them, but they proved last season that they could still challenge without him. But you wouldn't want to go out him for too long, especially in the form he's in right now.
No, and again, like you said, Leroy Sané putting pressure on Thibaut Courtois. It was an incident where Harry Kane put pressure on the Huddersfield goalkeeper, and actually you could have a go at him for not passing to a better placed teammate. But it all feeds into, like you say, that he's fast developing into the most complete striker, and that is down to hard work and dedication and no small amount of talent.
Yeah, I think I touched on it before. I think he is one of those players that just gets absolutely every last ounce of, ability out of his own body. He similar to Frank Lampard in that sense, where people didn't really think that initially that he had all of the attributes to be one of the best players in the Premier League, which he turned out to be. But I just think as well that with Kane, even if he doesn't score, and this will sound redundant because he keeps finding the back of the net, but if he doesn't score, he'll still contribute to a match. You know, he'll still set the tempo, set the press for the rest of his teammates to follow, and he'll still run himself into the ground, as he did against West Ham, wasn't it, whenever the Spurs were down to 10 men. So I think that's why, as we've touched upon before, that Pochettino absolutely loves him, and I think Kane's going to become even more integral to the team, even more vital to them in the next couple of seasons.
And of course, forgetting the fact he scored a hat-trick in midweek in the Champions League.
We'll get back to football in just a second, but first we'd like to tell you about the other podcasts from The National. Beyond the Headlines takes a deeper dive into the biggest news from the week with a distinct Middle Eastern point of view, and Business Extra is the best source in the region to learn more about the figures who make the region such an important hub in the world. Subscribe to both shows, as well as Extra Time, on iTunes. And as always, we're online at thenational.ae.
Okay, well, joining us on the phone now from Bolton in England is our Premier League correspondent, Richard Jolly. Now, Richard covered two games for us over the weekend. Let's start with Sunday's game at Goodison Park, Richard. Wayne Rooney benched, Umar Niasse brought in after his two-goal salvo against Bournemouth. But ultimately, none of it mattered, as Everton were beaten by a Burnley team that are now amassed more points on the road in their first seven games of this season than they did for the entirety of last term. Were Burnley worthy winners, in your view?
I thought so, yes. It's one of those games where the statistics are completely deceptive, in the sense that Everton had 23 shots, and I think Burnley only had about four. But Burnley were very, very comfortable. They defended really well, as they have done pretty much all season. The goalkeeper, Nick Pope, didn't really have a great deal to do. Burnley scored what was a really fantastic goal, the sort of goal that you wouldn't have associated with them certainly a few months back, let alone a few years ago, when they were really seen as quite a direct team, quite a long ball team. And it was a 24-pass move that involved nine players, some slick interpassing. You could tell the players are used to playing with each other and know where each other are going. And it had a neat finish from Jeff Hendrick, which I thought was quite significant. Because one of the reasons why Burnley's away form has been so much better this season than last season is that Sean Dyche has amended his tactics, and he was very much caricatured as a 4-4-2 man. And what he's done this season on the road, and which has worked really well, is to play 4-4-1-1, so that when Burnley don't have the ball, he's got an extra man in midfield, but when they do have it, they've got someone breaking forward to join the striker. And if you think back a couple of weeks to when they drew at Anfield, the man who scored the goal that day was Scott Arfield. He was the one joining the striker. You look yesterday at Goodison Park, the man scoring the goal, Jeff Hendrick, in exactly the same role, getting forward at the right time, finishing it in a way that any striker would have loved to have done, and putting Burnley ahead. And from then on, they played very, very well defensively. They're a team with fantastic organisation. They've got a real identity. They've bought really well. They're everything that Everton at the moment are not. Burnley know their strongest team. They know their game plan. They're in the top six on merit. And their away form, yes, it startled everyone, but if you actually go through the games and look at them, I think they probably deserved everything they've got on the road this season.
OK, well, let's move on to Everton, Richard. Ronald Koeman's position seems to be growing ever more precarious by the week. After a record outlay of signings over the summer, His side is 16th in the table with 4 defeats in their first 7 games. Now, are there rumblings of disquiet? There certainly seems to be amongst the fans, but are there rumblings of disquiet from the Everton hierarchy about his team selections, the style of play? Do you think his job is becoming untenable, or are the board going to give him time to turn this around?
I wouldn't use words like untenable, but I think you've arrowed in on the issue, and that's that the fans are upset. I don't think the board clearly won't be delighted, but I don't think that there's immediate pressure on Koeman. But if you look at Everton's recent history, it was the Everton fans who really turned on Roberto Martinez before the board did. And in the end, Martinez was sacked a few days before the final game of the season, because frankly, it would have been cruel to subject him to Goodison on that day. It would have just been so hostile. I think the points you've raised should all be a cause for concern for Everton. They spent £145 million. They're in the bottom five. Yes, they've had a tough fixture list. But the big concern is actually the manner of the performances and the fact that there just seem to be so many problems at Everton there. They haven't got a proper replacement for Romelu Lukaku, when everybody knew from at least March, and Everton ought to have known from earlier, that he was going to go. They've got a team that doesn't really have any pace, a team that doesn't really have any width. The football is really plodding. Koeman doesn't know his best team. He doesn't even know his best formation. The fact that, as you mentioned, Nias came into the starting 11 was in itself an admission that mistakes have been made, huge mistakes. The fact that Wayne Rooney was dropped was a sign that he hasn't had the impact required. There's real confusion going on in the recruitment, getting Rooney, Gylfi Sigurdsson, Davy Klassen, 3 number 10s. They've tried playing all 3 twice. It's really not worked. I think there's possibly a case you can't even play more than one of them. Now, Rooney's the Everton favourite, the man returning to his boyhood club, England's record scorer, United's record scorer. Sigurdsson's the £45 million player, Everton's record signing. And the strange thing is, having had those 3 number 10s, Koeman actually started against Burnley with, in effect, no number 10s, because Sigurdsson was the only one who actually was in the starting 11. He was playing off the left in a formation that, like everything he's done in recent games, doesn't work. The only thing I'd say is there was a point in Ronald Koeman's time at Southampton where they lost about 8 out of 10 games, which kind of got obscured because one of the ones they didn't lose was a 4-0 win over Arsenal. But they turned it round after that run of 8 defeats in 10. Koeman has accepted no responsibility so far, really, for Everton's problems, for their performances, for the team selections, which is one of the reasons why he is increasingly unpopular among the fans. But I just wonder if that self-belief, that sense that he knows what he's doing, will actually help him, because they may only need one result to get things back on track to some degree, even though at the moment you look at every department of the team and there are things wrong, and even the players that you would have regarded as the bankers in the teams, the ones you could rely upon to play well, they're not doing more. Morgan Schneiderlin's had a poor season. Ashley Williams is playing as badly as I've ever seen him play. But Everton, they could still turn it around. But if they don't, I think it'll be the fans who turn before the board, to be honest.
Okay, Rich, well, let's go back to Saturday's game that you covered for the National at Old Trafford. Manchester United kept up their sensational start to the season, particularly at Old Trafford, where they've been doing what they seldom failed to do to teams last season, and that's blowing them out of sight, this time against a hapless Crystal Palace. And there were a couple of players who really caught the eye in that game.
Yeah, there definitely were. I mean, Marcus Rashford, I thought, was terrific. He's in a strange situation in that he and Anthony Martial seem to be in a sort of job share this season, and it's actually working really well in that Martial's been absolutely electric, and then Rashford comes in and he sets up 2 goals, including the third-minute opener, which just makes it really easy from then on. And then there's Marouane Fellaini, who's the unlikely talisman for Mourinho's United, who scores twice. First time in a game for Manchester United, he scored twice. And it was one of those days where, until Romelu Lukaku scored late on, he wasn't actually having his best day. But it didn't matter at all, because Fellaini got basically 2 strikers' finishes inside the 6-yard box, one in open play, one from a set piece. And Fellaini kind of symbolises Mourinho's United, I think, because they're not purists in the way that Pep Guardiola's Manchester City are purists. But they are quite pragmatic, but at the same time, they are attacking and they are scoring goals. And this is what they did not do last season. I mean, as you mentioned, their home form last season was strangely poor, really. 10 home draws in the Premier League alone. This season, it's a 100% winning record. And I think one of the things that Mourinho has very pragmatically recognised is just that United need to score more goals. If you looked at the league table last season, Manchester United got 54. The five teams above them all got between 77 and 86. Well, the way United are going, and they've scored four goals in a game in, I think, four of their league games and six in all competitions, United should be in that 77 to 86 bracket this season. So if they don't win the league, I don't think it will be down to a lack of goals, and I don't think it will be because they haven't beaten the lesser teams at Old Trafford, which was their major problem last season.
Speaking of lesser teams, let's go on to Crystal Palace. Still without a point, still firmly rooted to the bottom of the table. And I don't know about you, Richie, it seems so much is being made of the fact that they're yet to score a goal that it's almost overlooking the massive problems that they've got at the back in the fact that they keep getting hammered so heavily in games. Now, obviously, you're not going to win games if you're not scoring, but you're certainly not going to win them if you keep shipping four, five, three goals in your matches.
Yeah, you're not. I mean, it's interesting to look at the games in which they've conceded, because in the last week they've let in nine goals in two games, but they were to Manchester City and Manchester United. Palace's defensive record from the first eight games was not that bad. They let in three on the opening day to Huddersfield, which was a terrible result, but they only let in one to Liverpool, one to Burnley, one to Southampton. I understand your question, but my view on that is that, A, when you've got this historically bad goalless start, there's obviously going to be a focus on that. B, looking at Roy Hodgson's track record and his methods, I do think Palace will improve defensively. I think Mamadou Sakho signing is a big one. He played a huge part in keeping them up last season. If you look to their team on Saturday, they were actually without three defenders. I mean, and of those three, Fosu Mensah would have been the first choice right back, and Joel Ward really struggled against Rashford. Either Scott Dan or James Tompkins would have played ahead of Damien Delaney at centre-back. So I think when Hodgson gets them back, and none of them are long-term issues, I mean, in the case of Fosu Mensah, he was ineligible because United is his parent club, I think the defensive record will improve. The thing that would worry me most of all about Crystal Palace's defending is that they're conceding early goals. And when you can't score, you need to keep a game at 0-0 for as long as possible in the hope the opposition will make a mistake. Well, Palace have been one down after 3 minutes against Manchester United, 3 minutes against Burnley, 6 minutes against Southampton. And it's game over from then on. And the other thing there is that the man you would want from everyone in the Crystal Palace squad to be on the pitch is Christian Benteke. He averages 14 or 15 Premier League goals a season. For the seasons when he's been playing for bottom half teams, he's out for about a month to 6 weeks. They don't have an alternative striker at all. Bakary Sakho played up front on Saturday. Roy Hodgson, after the game, called him a left winger from Wolves, which is accurate, but probably not the greatest endorsement of someone you'll ever hear. And they weren't even getting players into the box. And if you don't do that, it's going to be very, very difficult to score. Now, Palace have got Chelsea next, then they've got Newcastle away, which is actually shaping up as a pretty tough game. They've got an easier run of fixtures after that, but part of the problem is that the confidence could be completely shot if they've got eight or nine defeats on the trot with no goals. And the other problem is, how do they get out of it? Because you look at the league table, and if we go back a couple of months when everyone was making their predictions, a lot of people would have tipped Palace to finish ahead of various teams, including Burnley, including Watford, including Newcastle, including Huddersfield. Well, they're already 12 points behind Burnley and Watford. I think they're already 9 down on Huddersfield. They're already 10 down on Newcastle. So not only is it a long way back, but you also say, who are Crystal Palace realistically going to catch? Because one or two teams near the bottom, like Everton, are in a bit of a false position. And Everton won't finish 16th, they won't finish lower than 16th. So Palace have got to catch teams who are currently above Everton.
Right, gents, moving on to two of the league's probably slightly less fashionable teams, but Stoke left it late to pull off a win against Southampton, where it was a tale of two strikers for Mark Hughes' side. Serdar Berahino penalty saved, still searching for his first Stoke goal, still searching for his first Premier League goal since February 2016, in fact, and Peter Crouch, who after just a few minutes on the pitch managed to score what proved to be the winner just a few months shy of his 37th birthday. He's never been what you call prolific, is he, Colts? I think that one-yard tap-in was his 105th Premier League goal in 436 appearances. But he's a great option to have off the bench, isn't he? He's an aerial threat. He's very difficult for defenders to contain. He is an asset to that Stoke side.
Yeah, he did exactly what his manager wanted him to do. He put him on for the last 20 minutes, I think it was, and changed the game and won the game for them. And I think he's got 3 goals so far this season in 7 matches, and 2 of them have been from the bench. So it does show you that they have a genuine threat or a game changer to bring on whenever they need it. And he just keeps doing all the things that he's done since he's been in the Premier League, where he unsettles defenders. He encourages his own teammates to really put the foot down and get the ball into the box. And as we said, the old cliche, he's got a good touch for a big man. So we all know that that's not just what his game's all about, but it adds another dimension, and it's very, very difficult to defend against.
Poor Sadio Berahino, though, Gray. I mean, is it ever going to happen for him? Is he ever going to score in the Premier League again?
Well, knowing his luck, it'll probably be a complete deflection or something. Like, he probably needs to have a finish similar to what Jesselu had for Newcastle on Sunday. That's probably how it's going to go in. Sort of like
someone kicking it against his shin.
Yeah. So sometimes, you know, you can work so hard and like, and the thing is, obviously, we all think of penalties, but it was like, it was a good save by Fraser Forster, but it was exactly the right height. It was like no real conviction in it. Nothing about it screamed, I'm going to score this penalty.
And I almost think that taking a penalty to break your drought almost adds to the pressure, because even if you score it, people are going to say, oh, well, yeah, he only scored from the penalty spot. But it's got to come from some way, hasn't it? And you know, he was a very young striker who was greatly unsettled by the Tottenham interest in him some 18 months, 2 years ago now. And he's never really recovered from that. And you hope that a young lad like that, I think he's 24 years of age, can recover the kind of form that had him on Tottenham's radar.
I think the one thing that Mark Hughes can take heart from is the fact that he wanted to take the penalty, because he hasn't. It would be, as you said, it would be easy to sort of hide away from it if the confidence in there. He obviously had some form of confidence to try and take it. So it's a cliche, but all you can do is just stay out.
I don't think Shaqiri was too happy now. No,
probably not. And probably Peter Crouch would have fancied himself off the bench as well, probably, to do that. So, yeah, I think all he can do is, like a cliche, is just keep doing what you're doing. And sort of, as long as Stoke are winning, I don't think Hughes will mind too much, but.
Yeah, interesting after the match that Mark Hughes said that Stoke had played better the previous week, a 4-0 defeat to Chelsea, than they did in this 2-1 win against Southampton.
Yeah, I'm not too sure about that. But going back to the Berahino thing, I think he moved there in January, was it the winter transfer window? He went to Stoke for £12 million, I think it was. He hasn't scored since then. He missed a couple of penalties against West Brom, in fact, at one stage. So, you just, with him, I think it seems like his career's at a bit of a crossroads, because I'm nearly sure that it was Gareth Southgate said last week, was comparing him to Kane, saying that whenever he was England under 21 manager, that Berahino was not streets ahead, but he was keeping Harry Kane out of the team. And you just look how their two careers have gone in completely different directions. So I don't know how you manage that. I don't know whether or not you take him out of the team for a while, or you tell him, as Graham says, to keep doing what he's doing, but he's just not doing it very well. So it's a difficult one.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, moving on to a team who are slowly building quite ahead of steam. It was all doom and gloom at the end of August following a 4-0 defeat to Liverpool and the Alexis Sanchez transfer saga. But credit to Arsenal, they've turned things around in September. A draw against Chelsea, wins over Bournemouth, West Brom, now Brighton, Hove, Albion. Going well in the Europa League. Arsene Wenger deserves a bit of credit for turning Arsenal's early season fortunes around.
Oh, definitely. Considering the fact that, like, I remember we were sat in the office at the end of August panicking on deadline because the Liverpool game was that bad that we thought he actually might go after that because he looked broken on the... He's had plenty of times to look sort of disappointed and had that despairing look in his face, but that Liverpool game was absolutely awful. And in a way, the international break came at exactly the right time because it probably did give him a couple of weeks once they'd got the usual disappointment of the transfer window out of the way. But they had a couple of weeks to kind of sort themselves out. And I think that Chelsea draw really has given them some confidence because it wasn't like it was a back-to-the-wall, hold-on-for-dear-life. They were well worth it, yep. Well worth the point. And they've kind of, you know, you can sort of say these other games have been games you'd expect them to win, but you've still got to do it.
Yeah.
And he's trying to bring Alexis Sanchez back into the side after the fact, like he wanted to go in the transfer window and the fact they weren't going to sell him or they were going to sell him at the last minute and messed it up. And stuff. So it's not being easy for them. But as you said, there's a lot to admire in how they've turned that around.
Yeah, and as you say, the draw against Chelsea, they're in fifth place, level on points with Chelsea, in fourth on 13 points. So it's, you know, maybe the Liverpool defeat was overblown, you know, probably by the size of the defeat more than anything else, Colts.
Mm-hmm. Well, they were particularly bad in that match. As well, this week, they played what I think it was 64 hours after they'd played in the Europa League, so they've managed to get over that tricky hurdle that a lot of teams in previous seasons have not been able to. So it was, I know that they were playing Brighton at home, but it was a considerable test of their mettle, which Arsenal aren't usually famed for, to be honest. And Wenger made, what was it, 9 changes to the starting lineup.
Yeah, he's using his squad very well, isn't he? He's giving the likes of Giroud and Walcott a run out in the Europa League, Jack Wilshere as well. He seems to be managing the balance of that side very well. Highlighted, I guess, by Nacho Monreal's first goal in, what is it, 4 years?
Yeah.
I've had 2 children in between that time, so that's how long it's been.
I thought as well, I don't know what you guys think, but Ozil wasn't playing again. And I don't know, the past few times that Arsenal have played without him, I think they look a lot better or a lot more cohesive. I don't know. What's your take on that?
Well, I think Alex Iwobi is a very underrated player. I think he brings a lot to that team. I know what you're saying about Ozil. I don't think he's at that world-class level anymore. But yeah, no. We're talking about teams like Brighton and Bournemouth that Arsenal should be blowing away. But yeah, I think there's a case to be made for that, definitely.
No, I completely agree with Ozil. And what you said there, Steve, about world-class, because you probably can count on one hand the number of times, say last season, he took control of a game and sort of ran them. And that's not enough, really. And sort of like, and the problem is, you don't get enough of the good stuff from him. And then when he's off his game, he disappears completely. Yeah. And you may as well be down to 10 men, really, quite frankly, for the amount he produces from a game. And it clearly does affect some of the other players as well when he's as poor as he can be, like in the Liverpool game particularly. Like when he's really off his, when he's really gone, it's awful to watch. And so, as you said, it's no coincidence that there does seem to be not just how they're winning, but a little bit more cohesiveness to it, really.
Okay, another team that we very rarely talk about, but Watford battled back from 2 goals down to earn a point against West Brom with an equaliser in the 5th minute of injury time. Richarlison, the scorer, he's fast looking like one of the finds of the season. But there's a great resolve to this Watford team now this season, Gray, that's probably not been there since they got promoted back to the Premier League. It certainly wasn't there last season, and they're on a terrific run of form under Marco Silva.
Well, when you think of how badly they ended the season, because in fairness to Walter Mazzarri, he had them safe by the middle of April, but it was a good job he did because they lost the last 6 games of the season.
Yeah.
And Pep Guardiola almost called a timeout on Man City in the last game because I think they were 5-0 up after 55 minutes. And Guardiola went for
that, that was a game you flew home for, wasn't it?
Yeah. Continuing the outstanding life choices. Going in, when it was announced he was going, it was like, clearly might be a good thing for the club. And like Marco Silva obviously did a hell of a job at Hull. But you're thinking there's still a concern at the start of the season. There's still quite a lot of deadwood in that squad. But he's done a cracking job of sort of moving around some of the squad players, and people like Doucouré, who weren't really a regular fixture in the side last season, have really kicked on and come on. It'll be interesting how they cope without Chalabar for the next couple of months, because he's really kicked in since coming into the side. But as you said, it's been mainly like the heart and the desire, and like obviously that's sometimes overrated because it is just people kicking a ball around
at
the simplicity. But you know, last season Watford would not have got anything out of that game.
No, and that's what I mean. They were two goals down. Richarlison got the assist for Doucouré, won the free kick from which he ultimately scored the equaliser from. He looks a fantastic player, and he's great value on Fantasy Premier League as well. I couldn't afford him, but I really wish I had.
He just looks as if he wants to make something happen every time he gets the ball, and I think cleverly described him as fearless, and it does feel that way. And he's a bit of a find. He came from Fluminense, was it?
Yeah.
So I think what he's brought to the team is just, he gives them that, I don't know if it's X factor, it gives them that little something different that perhaps they were lacking to a certain extent last year. And as Steve-O, you mentioned earlier on that, you know, Silva deserves a lot of credit for Troy Deeney's been kind of pushed to one side, wherever, when last year it seemed that everything had to revolve around him. Was he club captain? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think Silva's made some really, really big decisions there. And I think it's a measure of how far they've come this season and the expectation that, as I touched upon earlier, that they were 2-0 down. They came back away to West Brom, which Hawthorn's a difficult place to go traditionally. Yeah. And at the end, Silva looked absolutely gutted that the final whistle had gone and that he didn't have more time for, or his team didn't have more time to push for the winner. So things look very, very good for them. And it surprises me, because at the beginning of the season, because of the finish they had last year, as Graham touched upon, I didn't think that they'd do particularly well this year, but they've outperformed what I was expecting.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, if you look back to the opening game of the season, the comeback against Liverpool as well, you know, there's a real fighting spirit in that team. And like you said, Gray, it deserted them too many times last season. But what has Marco Silva done so drastically to their team? As you touched on, Colts, now Troy Deeney has been largely sidelined to not to a starting role. It's not like Marco Silva's revolutionised that team in some great way, but whatever he's doing, he's working. Is that every away game they've scored in now?
Yeah, they're unbeaten away. They're all against teams that you probably would expect them to get points. Well, if they're going to be strong mid-table. But I think the key thing he's probably brought into the team has been pace. Because, like, Troy Deeney's a lot of things for Watford. Like, he's the captain, he leads by example, he's a lead on the pitch, but he's not fast.
No.
And that was one of
Watford's... I'd fancy my chances in a foot race.
That's been one of Watford's biggest issues, particularly last season, and particularly if they conceded the first goal. If they had to try and break a team down, it was a very odd setup they had last year on the Mazzari, where they didn't have any fixed wingers, and they had a striker who was very, very slow as a main target man. So it obviously, unsurprisingly, didn't really go very well. Well, Gray, he's only got one goal so far this season, but he offers him a bit more, stretches him a little more. Richarlison sort of floats around and really sort of goes at that pace. And Doucouré and Chalabar charge around like a pair of like hyenas, just chasing every ball down. And it's kind of just given him a little bit more to think about. So when, as I said, Deeney's only made his first start of the season on Saturday, and Etienne Capoue's been an established member of the side since Watford got promoted. He's only been a bit part player. He's getting game time now because of Chalabar's injury. But it kind of shows the fact, like, Silva's obviously given a lot of the squad chances and such, but he's not being afraid to shake it up. And I think it has kind of worked, and the proof's in the pudding. It'll be interesting to see what they do after the international break, because they've got Arsenal at home and Chelsea away. And as well as they've done, they're clearly against the top sides, they've still got a problem defensively, in that they were lucky just to concede three against Liverpool. And City, probably if they'd wanted it, could have had more than six as well. So that's probably the only bit Silva's probably going to be working on a little bit more during the international break.
Great stuff. Well, it's been another fantastic show. Colts, thanks very much for joining us.
Cheers, Steve.
Graham, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having us.
Subscribe on iTunes to download all of the National's Extra Time podcasts, or you can find us on the website at thenational.ae/sport.